Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. We're going to be talking during this program to two authors from the Fall Book Fiesta that's happening here in Santa Fe this Saturday, the 24th of October. And at the end of the program, we're going to be speaking with violinist Midori. I'm delighted now to welcome Margaret Moore Booker. She's author of the new book, The Santa Fe House, Historic Residences, Enchanting Adobes, and Romantic Revivals. And she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Friday, October 23rd, from 6 to 8 in the evening. And then Saturday, she will be at the Santa Fe Fall Book Fiesta, which is from 10 to 4 in the afternoon, 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, at Clearlight Book Gallery at 851 San Mateo Road in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
So I saw this beautifully this beautifully done book with incredible photographs and, you know, nice amount of text. And I thought, okay, coffee table book. And then I started reading it and I realized it was as much a view into the social fabric of Santa Fe as it was anything else through the lens of architecture.
Yes, thank you for noticing that, because it's definitely not your typical coffee table book. It's full of historic resources and so forth. But, that's part of the enchanting quality of the Santa Fe historic architecture, is that there are these wonderful families that have lived there through the different generations, and they've all added their own particular tastes to each of these houses.
And the limitations, for example, the economic limitations of each time and so on, are reflected. For example, in the earliest period, the period from, the 17th century to through the 18th century, what were the houses made of and how were they furnished?
Well, they were pretty sparse. They were made of mud, adobe bricks, and then they were mud plastered. And often they'd have just a little bit of wood trim around the windows, and the windows and doors would be covered with sheepskin, and sometimes the windows would be covered with mica. And the roofs were poles and, you know, simple timbers and then dirt on top. And they were very sparsely furnished, sometimes locally made things and sometimes items that were brought up from Mexico along the Santa Fe Trail. So pretty basic.
And the women had the role of being the mud plasterers.
Yes, they did. That's a particular interest of mine. It began actually with the Pueblo Indian women, and then I believe they taught Hispanic women how to do the mud plastering. And that's a tradition that's carried on today in both those communities, Pueblo and Hispanic communities in New Mexico.
And mud plastering kind of went out of fashion for a while, but it's kind of come back in.
It is. There are fewer people, obviously, around who have that skill. But yes, there are people who are restoring buildings who want to bring it back to that authentic look and are indeed using the mud plastering.
And probably for ecological reasons as well?
Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely, definitely.
So what are some examples in Santa Fe that people might know about of this earliest period of architecture?
Well, it's actually hard to find the real old buildings because so many of them have changed over the years. You know, the different owners have, as I said, added their kind of their own taste, you know, and added on rooms and so forth. But even the so-called oldest house on East of Vargas does have many aspects of the earliest building. So you can get a feeling at that place. And also the Palace of the Governors does have some aspects of that.
When they put animal skins over the windows, did that let some light through?
Yeah, I think so, because they were probably tanned very thin, and so there would be some light. But not a whole lot. You know, those early buildings were very dark.
So Santa Fe was officially part of Mexico for only 25 years. But in those 25 years, was there an effect of being part of Mexico on the architecture?
There weren't a huge amount of changes then. I think that the biggest change would be the items that were in the house. or houses. Again, they were more and more items were brought up from Mexico. So I think they might have had more elaborate furniture and that kind of thing.
It's funny because when you think about the early period, you think about, for example, going to the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art on Museum Hill. But, of course, that's the fancy stuff. That's not the way ordinary people live.
Exactly. That's not your typical Santa Fe house from that time period. But it still gives you some idea of a few of the things that they would have had.
The territorial period, that's the part after we were no longer Mexico, we were territory of the United States, not yet statehood. What kind of influences came from the U.S., from the North American political change?
Right. From the states, they would say. A lot of things are brought by the wagon load from the states. For instance, milled lumber that was used for doors, window frames, and they brought glass, and they brought bricks until they were finally made here, and they basically followed what was popular in the Midwest and East, and that was Greek Revival. So the window frames and door frames often had these pediments, and then they would install the bricks along the cornice or the top of the exterior wall and situate them so that they look like Greek dentils. So that was a huge change, that time period in Santa Fe architecture. So there were all the Anglo-Americans came from the States with all these new ideas, and they wanted to basically dress up the simple adobes.
And so this is, we're talking about the second half of the 19th century.
Right, right.
What was the mix of Santa Fe society like in that territorial period, the second half of the 19th century?
Well, it was an enormous mix because you had Pueblo Indians and you had, the native Hispanic and people of both Spanish and Mexican descent, and various other ethnicities had moved into the area. So it was an interesting time, I think.
When you have these people from the states, so-called, coming and bringing their bricks and their glass and their milled lumber and so on, we know later in the early 20th century, there was very much of a Pueblo revival, which influences the way Santa Fe looks to this day. But at that time, how much did they respect or use the existing architecture versus importing their own aesthetics from elsewhere?
Well, they really combined the two during the territorial period. But then that evolved in the late 19th century when we move into the Victorian era. Then I would say they really wanted to discard the older adobes and move into what they considered modern buildings of, eclectic European-inspired Victorian architecture. It's the Second Empire, Queen Anne, Italianate, and that kind of thing. And then they brought in the new materials for that, sometimes even cast iron elements and so forth. And then by that time, of course, they had the railroad to bring in all these new supplies.
The railroad had a huge influence in so many ways, including architectural, just simply in terms of building materials.
Oh, exactly. And so it was much easier to transport all these, heavy items. And, of course, they were either made in the Midwest or East, and then they could be easily transported. As compared to when they had to bring them in by the wagon, it was much easier with the railroad.
You, in this book, The Santa Fe House, Historic Residences, Enchanting Adobes, and Romantic Revivals, talk about and illustrate some existing houses, some individual houses with their addresses. And, of course, many of them, for those of us who live here, are very familiar sites, but we don't know what the history of these places is. There were some quite wealthy merchants who built mansions. There was a wonderful-sounding Syrian merchant?
Nathan Salmon. I spoke with his family. His descendants are still in Santa Fe, and they take part in running the Lenzic, actually. And it's really sketchy how he first arrived here, but he had kind of a business that he just ran out of a cart that was, you know, led by a horse around town. And then eventually he became a very prominent businessman. And when he built his house on what is now Paseo de Peralta, in that wonderful Spanish Mission Revival style with the arches and the red barrel tile roof and so forth, that was a pretty big deal. And it was written about in the newspaper as, you know, there's this big mansion going up built by this prominent merchant.
And it seems that the New Mexican, the daily paper, was very much a source for you in writing this book, because they, every time somebody started to build a house or finished a house, they wrote about it.
Exactly. It was big news, you know, when these, especially during that time period, late 19th and early 20th century, when these big houses were going up. But I spent countless hours going through rolls of microfilm of the New Mexican. It was tedious, but I was rewarded, you know, and found some great comments, you know, about these different houses.
You also found some old black and white pictures of these houses, some of them 80 years old or older, which you then put next to the current beautiful, sumptuous color pictures of the same places.
Right, right. And it's interesting to note changes. You know, often the exterior material will have changed from shingle to stucco or whatever. So it's fun to have that comparison. And a lot of those photos came from the Palace of Governors photo archives. And then in some instances, family members would share their photos with me.
We're talking to Margaret Moore Booker. The book is called The Santa Fe House. Some of these big houses, now we think of people coming in and building mansions a little bit outside of Santa Fe or in the hills, and there's always controversy about them when somebody tries to build on a hilltop and so on. But 100 years ago or more, they were building houses right in town, big mansions that are now, some of which are now hotels and restaurants.
Right, exactly. And there really wasn't any controversy about it then, but it was, as I said, newsworthy. But, yeah, it was mostly concentrated in town. Well, Palace Avenue, for instance, that became a big area for wealthy merchants to build their houses.
La Posada is a great example.
Yes, it is. I think it's remarkable. That's the Staub family mansion. And so hidden behind the stucco facade of the hotel is this wonderful Victorian building. If you go inside, a lot of the original interior is still there.
It's amazing to go into La Posada just to have a drink and walk around and see how this thing is, because in some ways you don't feel like you're in Santa Fe in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. It takes you back to the 19th century. Yeah.
And that was a three-story house originally.
Yes, and I believe they had a fire, and they lost that third story. But they, you know, the hotel is doing a wonderful job maintaining that historic interior.
Let's go back in time a little bit. I wanted to talk about this before. Was the Palace of the Governors. What's the history of that building?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's long and varied, and some people have said, you know, why did you include that? And it's, you know, the governors did actually live there, so it was their, you know, residence over the decades. And as I said earlier, it does have many historic features. When they did some excavations recently, they found some old cobblestone foundations, which probably do date to that very original time period in the, you know, 1600s. But during the Pueblo Revolt, a lot of the original structure was destroyed. So, you know, what we look at today is, you know, a combination of, you know, various elements that were added over the year. But they did a good replication, I think, of the earliest building.
And, of course, that historically has been how Santa Fe adobe houses were in the first place. A lot of people who live in old adobes, there's an original structure and then another room and then another room, and they grew in a very organic way.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I wrote a book on Nantucket architecture, and they back there they would call them warts. So you'd have the original structure, and then, you know, they'd start to add these little rooms on, and that's what they called them there. But so it's very much the same here. Yeah.
So not only did people come to live in Santa Fe, merchants, people coming from the East to sell things, there were also real artisans. I was interested to see there are stonemasons from Italy and from France who came, I guess, to serve the needs of these of these people who were building these fabulous houses?
Well, a lot of them were brought over by Archbishop Lamy when he was building St. Francis Cathedral. And then after they finished that project, they stayed on and became contractors and builders in Santa Fe. And then they were hired by many of these merchants to build these new Victorian homes that had features in them, you know, that pretty much only an artisan trained in Europe could do. So it was kind of a natural progression for those artisans.
What are some of those specialties that only European-trained artisans could do?
Well, I think plaster moldings and that kind of thing, and curving staircases and, you know, a lot of the woodwork. Because if you think about it, previous to that, we're talking about pretty simple mud buildings. And so when we moved into these more elaborate buildings, you really did need a special artisan to do those different aspects.
The building of the St. Francis Cathedral, a great Romanesque building, which is still very impressive to this day, was a huge change in the cityscape of Santa Fe at the time.
Yes, exactly. And I really think that the Archbishop deserves credit for, in many ways, bringing this European aesthetic to Santa Fe and kind of the first person to do that.
How did people respond to it in the documents that you read at the time?
For the most part, I think they were pretty happy about it. You know, I think that, especially the newspaper, for instance, the editors and writers for the paper, local paper, saw this as bringing Santa Fe into modern times. So it was well received.
Another aspect of bringing Santa Fe into modern times was the eventual demise of the dirt roof. And there's some actually somewhat amusing commentary about dirt roofs that you came across and put in the book.
Oh, exactly. The newspaper, again, the Santa Fe New Mexican, would talk extensively about these dirt roofs being old-fashioned. And there was a particularly rainy day in the summer of 1868. And the editor the next day wrote this piece that said, you know, the rain has been incessant. And it's, you know, all the roofs in Santa Fe are leaking like sieves. And, you know, it's making housewives upset, and it's ruining furniture, and it's unhealthy, and all this. And it's pretty funny, and you know, they said, please, would you cover your dirt roofs with wood planks? You know, not only is it aesthetically pleasing, but, you know, it will stop the leaking from your roof. And I think they saw the dirt roof as a symbol kind of old-fashioned Santa Fe, and they saw these wood planks as a way to, you know, come into the modern times as far as architecture goes. And shortly after that, it was the early 1870s that Santa Fe's did finally start using wood planks. And then tin roofs.
So tin roofs probably represented a huge step forward in keeping the rain off of your personal self when you were indoors.
Oh, exactly.
The Victorian period in Santa Fe still has these wonderful examples, some of which you illustrate in the book in which you've talked about, but also some of it is gone because of the Pueblo Revival style.
Exactly. In the early 20th century, shortly after statehood in 1912, city planners were looking into what kind of architecture they wanted to have as the style for Santa Fe. And they chose what they call the New Old Style, which is based on Spanish and Pueblo Revival styles. And it was at that point that they wanted to get rid of what they called the American styles, which were the bungalows and the Victorian buildings. And in many instances, they just tore them down, or in other instances, they stuccoed over them. So there's still some examples in town that, you know, hidden beneath layers of stucco or adobe, you would find, you know, these wonderful wood frame Victorian houses.
Has anybody chipped them away?
No. You could, though.
Too much work, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because in a way, what we think of as this wonderful, unique, special Santa Fe style, at the time, could have been viewed as a kind of homogenization of the architectural styles of the city.
Yeah, I suppose so. But they were trying to turn, you know, Santa Fe into a tourist place, and this was seen as, you know, one way to attract people was to have this one particular style that everyone built in an authentic manner, and they thought that would be more pleasing than all these so-called American styles. You know, they thought people from back east would come out to Santa Fe to see these Pueblo and Spanish-inspired buildings that was so much a part of the city.
So there was really this setting up Santa Fe as a very consciously as a tourist destination.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that was all on their mind. Well, they really needed to, because the economy had really declined, you know, around the turn of the century, and so that was their hope, and seems to have worked.
Right, and here we are going strong, still a tourist destination, still pinning our hopes on that more and less at different times.
Yeah, definitely.
We're talking to Margaret Moore Booker. The book is called The Santa Fe House. I'm very happy that you used the word house and not home. Home is one of those words that has been kind of taken by the real estate industry, but houses are the architectural structures.
Right, right. That's interesting that you noticed that. But yeah, you're right.
So the houses that were built by these families, and of course many of the names, again, for those of us who live in Santa Fe and have been, you know, walking around for a long time, many of the names are familiar. Are any of the houses that you focused on still in the families of the people whose ancestors built them?
Very few, very few. I think there might only be one or two that appear in the book, and I think that they would probably prefer that I not mention who they are. For the most part, everyone was really excited to be in the book, but there are some people who really value their privacy.
Sure.
And but so not many.
But quite a number of them are now, in fact, commercial buildings of one kind or another. Geronimo's is in the book, for example, the restaurant.
Exactly. And then, of course, as we were talking about, the Victorian house that's now La Posada. But what's neat about that is that now people can go into these historic houses, you know, and see the different styles. For instance, the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art up on Museum Hill, that's a meme building. And, you know, most of Meme's buildings, his early houses in particular, are privately owned, so you can't see them. But that is a wonderful example of his style, and it's now a museum, so anyone can go in and look at his style.
John Gaw Meme, an interesting character. I didn't realize until I read this that he never finished architecture school.
I know, it's pretty shocking when you think about it. I mean, he did some tremendously beautiful buildings here in Santa Fe, but he didn't have that basic training.
And so, and yet, probably the most famous architect in the history of this city.
Yep.
So you worked with a wonderful photographer.
Steve Larice.
And I'm so struck by people who can photograph architecture and find just the right time of year, time of day, angle of the light to make these houses look even more beautiful than they already do.
Yeah, Steve is very talented. He was the photo editor at New Mexico Magazine for about 10 years. He's gone freelance, and I was lucky to catch him right after he'd left the magazine, and he was interested in working with me, and we would go out together to these different buildings, and but it was really his terrific eye. You know, he was really good at capturing all those architectural details in the houses themselves. And he definitely would go back, you know, many times to get that perfect shot.
So what surprises did you encounter in the making of this book?
Well, the biggest surprise for me was to discover that so many women were involved in early 20th century architecture here in Santa Fe. They were involved in every aspect. We were talking earlier about the mud plastering. But also they were architects and designers and builders, and a lot of them were also patrons, you know, clients. And there was a really strong network of women who were involved in the whole architecture scene here. They also were prominent in the movement to preserve historic buildings here. So that was pretty interesting, and that's a subject I hope to explore in a future publication.
And that's an interest of yours in general, women's history.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've written biographies and on women, and it's always been a particular interest of mine. So I was excited to make that discovery when I was working on this book.
The book is called The Santa Fe House, Historic Residences, Enchanting Adobes, and Romantic Revivals by Margaret Moore Booker. And Margaret will be tomorrow night, Friday, the 23rd of October at Collected Works Bookstore from 6 to 8 in the evening here in Santa Fe on Galisteo Street. And then the next day, Saturday, she will be at the Santa Fe Fall Book Fiesta, which is from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon at Clearlight Book Gallery at 851 West San Mateo in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome Pamela Christie. She is the author of the book Dead Lizards Dance, A Tale of Love, Murder, and Witchery in Old Santa Fe. And her first book, The King's Lizard, was the winner of the Zia Book Award of the New Mexico Press Women. And she will be speaking at the Fall Book Fiesta of Santa Fe at the Clearlight Book Gallery on Saturday, October 24th. It's from 10 to 4. It's a free event at 851 West San Mateo Road in Santa Fe. Welcome, Pamela, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me here today.
So this book is set in the late 18th century Santa Fe.
1782,
the Kingdom of New Mexico. And it's so interesting that we are talking to you right after we talked to Margaret Moore Booker, who's talking about the architecture throughout this period. And like that, this book gives you such a sense of the underpinnings of the place that we're living in now.
Thank you. I agree.
Let's talk about your character, your narrator, Nando. Who is he? How did you develop this character?
Two different questions. Nando is a 22-year-old young man, boy, right on the cusp of both, whose father was a Spanish don, wealthy by New Mexico standards, gentry. His mother was that man's Ute slave. So Nando is a half-breed, and as such, he doesn't belong to either culture particularly well, although he was taught to read and write by his Spanish stepmother. So he's a step ahead of most half-breeds. And in the first book, when Governor Anza finds this out about him, he is thrilled to have somebody who can be a vector across cultural and economic levels, somebody who could actually speak Ute, therefore Comanche, somebody who can speak Spanish, even a little Latin. He's got somebody that he could use in his spy network in this young man.
And use him he does. What's wonderful about this book is, many wonderful things, but it starts out with a murder. You aren't even a few pages in, and you've got a dead man hanging from the rafters.
You do indeed. There are certain lines I come across when I'm reading history that just catch me, and I'm off and running with a story. And one of them was that one of the typical ways to kill a witch in those times and in other times was to hang them over a beam and by their elbows behind them and leave them there. Pretty grisly. Definitely caught my attention. Somehow, when I read these lines, a novel starts to form and you're holding it in your hands.
That's right. So let's talk about the witchcraft aspect of it. What, at that point, defined a witch, and how did you do the research to find that out?
Well, happily, there are excellent books. Mark Simmons has written at least one about witchcraft in New Mexico. What I got interested in was what happened to women who were outcasts, who were on the margins of society. And in that time, many women were captured as young girls or young women and brought into households. And they were taken out of their own culture. And suddenly, they just were other. I mean, they had a different name, a different religion. They had no protection of their family or their tribe. What happened to these women? And many women were forced into servitude out of the pueblos, and often put, first of all, to work in the palace of the governors, and very quickly were impregnated and were adrift in society. I mean, nobody was supporting them or their children. And I have never been able to find out if they were allowed to go home to their Pueblo people if they got the chance, with their Spanish offspring. I think probably in some cases they were, and in other cases they weren't. So there are all these women, and there are also the poor and the marginally mentally ill ones and widows. What happens to them? And in many cases, as in all cultures, somebody different is deemed to be a witch. And there was just a horrible article in our paper the other day about children in Africa who are being tormented for this. So I was interested in this question. And there's been an excellent book written called The Witches of Abiquiu. And it goes into a whole witch exorcism problem in Abiquiu in about 1764, which is almost the time of my book. So it was a big issue in this country in those days, in this territory.
Now, some of it was, as you point out, based on just simply the fact of otherness and all the fear that goes around with that. But also, there were women who were herbalists or who were healers or who did things outside of the confines of Catholicism.
Absolutely, and they were at risk all the time. The Spanish Inquisition was actually at work in New Mexico looking for people who combined healing with ceremony and considered that absolutely illegal and grounds for all kinds of punishment. And that comes up in this book. And yet I try not to make it too gruesome. I mean, my women are fun, and one or two of them happen to be the lovers of my sleuth, Nando. We get to know these women as they're walking through the mountains, digging their herbs, and we see how they have to fight for their survival. And another thing that really interested me is some women chose to be known as witches. They got power from that. And I was very interested in that question alongside this general concern.
So, of course, we don't want to give away too much of the plot of the book, because if you do that to a murder mystery, then you're just a bad person.
Thank you.
But there is a lot about, and I always wonder when people are writing historical fiction, how much accuracy they're striving for. In other words, were you trying to really imitate the way people spoke, the way they dressed, the way they had their hair, the way their houses were? I mean, obviously you have to be accurate on what vehicles or animals they rode and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's a huge research project rife with opportunities for gross errors.
Yeah, there have been a few, too. I think I learned some of the languaging in the first book. I mean, I would try to make them sound somewhat contemporary, because I don't think people actually have changed that much over the last 250 years. I mean, they're still having fights with their girlfriends and annoyed at their mothers and, you know, struggling to earn a living. And I need language that it makes a modern reader relate to them. But I also couldn't say zip your mouth, because they didn't have zippers then. And I learned this as I was writing. And I think the second book is more finely honed for that. The language is closer. And I tried to base it on real history, yet the whole book is rank fiction. Some historians object to that, others love it. I made up the story. Governor Anza was real, and he's in this book. There are a couple of other characters who did live in those times, but generally speaking, it's all something, well, we live in Santa Fe, all something I channeled. Does that work?
Really?
No, I'm just kidding.
But I mean, a lot of authors, I mean, forget about the mystical New Age nonsense aspect of it, but there are a lot of authors who get their ideas from some weird place, and the novel just kind of unfolds by itself in a way that it's not just conscious invention.
I think both happen. I mean, there was a lot of conscious invention with this one, because I really wanted this book to get off on a racing good start, and I plotted it more than I did the first one. But then your characters take over. I mean, you find them in bed with the wrong people. You find them at the wrong end of the county, on the wrong animal. And you've got to rein them in from time to time. I mean, they get characters of their own, and they start to take off on you. And that's really fun when that happens.
One of the things that I know that you're interested in is this whole phenomenon of book clubs. Have you found that book clubs are taking up your book and reading it and then talking about it?
Well, I hope they do with this one. I certainly had great success and fun with book clubs in the past with The King's Lizard. I like to go and talk about the book and let the women just have at me, which they do sometimes. But I think book groups, book clubs are the sort of great underground intellectual stream in this country. Women and men too in the book groups, but mostly women, the ones I go to, are really studying and thinking and supporting literature and books as they do it. And I love to work with them. And one of my most, and feel free to call me, PR Christie in the phone book, if you want me to talk to your book group. And another thing that I love doing is speaking to classrooms of kids. And I was
what kind of questions are children asking you?
Well, I went to one classroom in Las Vegas, New Mexico, eighth graders. This is for the first book. And they came into the room after I was sitting there for a minute, dressed in the costumes of my characters.
Oh, my
it
goodness.
It blew my mind. And the children came up to me, one of them dressed as Nando, and said, "Why did you make me the most important person in the book?" And another person who was dressed as the prostitute Rosa said, "Why did you kill me?" And there I was being interrogated by my own characters. It was a fabulous morning. So
that's one great teacher they've got there who's having them act this out.
John McLeod at the Charter School up in Las Vegas. But anyway, I love talking to kids. I think this book is more suited to high school kids than grade school kids. But I'm also a tour guide at Golondrinas, and I work with the children out there. And you talk about architecture. I mean, our architecture in 1782 was mud. Mud and sticks and stones.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes falling on your head.
Often, yeah.
Pamela Christie is author of the book Dead Lizards Dance, A Tale of Love, Murder, and Witchery in Old Santa Fe. And she will be at the Clearlight Book Gallery on Saturday, October 24th, it's an event called the Fall Book Fiesta from 10 to 4 in the afternoon. It's free, and it's at 851 West San Mateo Road.
I think there are going to be about 30 authors there, and if you're getting started on your Christmas shopping, here's a chance to get something eclectic and delicious at the same time. There will really be an array of books there.
You know, it's a really good point, actually, just in terms of the purely shopping element of this, which is that just like a flea market or a craft show where you get one-of-a-kind items, your book isn't one-of-a-kind, but it's also something that you may not find in a big chain bookstore or something like that. It may not have the distribution. So if you actually go to an event like this, you can meet all sorts of authors and get books that you wouldn't readily find otherwise.
There are very interesting people writing books in Santa Fe. Last time I was carried by boarders here, and I sold over 200 books of The King's Lizard. And this time when I went in to get distribution of the new book, Dead Lizards Dance, they said that their corporate policy had changed and they couldn't take any local books. So there I was. And they gave me a number to call to see if I could discuss this with the main boarder's office. And I called that number and it hung up on me. I was flabbergasted.
There's your corporate policy.
There's your corporate policy. So think of all the people in this country who are writing really fine things who are excluded from the big corporate chains under a policy like that. No wonder they're going out of business.
Well, Pamela Christie, we look forward to seeing you at the Santa Fe Fall Book Fiesta, and thanks again for being with us.
Well, it's always fun to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
And we hope you come back soon.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you. We just heard Paganini's Caprice No. 1 in E, performed by violinist Midori, who joins us now by telephone. She made her concert debut when she was 11 years old with the New York Philharmonic under Zubin Mehta, and since then has recorded and performed with the world's greatest orchestras and conductors, and she's won many of the highest awards in music. In addition to performing, recording, and teaching, she brings music to people who don't otherwise have access through several community-based nonprofit organizations. And she will be in Santa Fe this coming Tuesday, October 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, sponsored by the Santa Fe Concert Association. Midori, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you achieved tremendous musical accomplishments very early in your life, and I was very curious to know, when you play pieces now that you played when you were, say, 12 years old or 15 years old, how is it different now?
I think it's very different in many ways. It's not always possible to actually describe it verbally, but it is very different. People, you know, grow. People change, and pieces within them change. Many things change. The world changes as well. So everything is different.
When you are a student, when you're young, there are long hours of practice. There's time for contemplation and discussion of the music and so on. And now as a performing artist, you've got a heavy touring schedule, you teach, you're deeply committed to volunteering and community work. How do you build in time for the creative process?
I find the time, or the time finds me, I would say. I enjoy being able to do various things that I do in my life because they stimulate each other and they are part of the creative process.
Do you have sometimes long stretches of days where you can just be alone or be with your music?
I'm with my music every day.
Right, right. There's this question that you write about very eloquently on your website, and it's about this question of interpretation. There are so many considerations when you approach a new piece of music, and I wondered if you could describe a little bit your process of coming to a new piece and thinking about it, how to interpret it.
I think that interpretation is something that takes a long time, and it's always a chain reaction, and there isn't one exact way of interpreting a piece. It's also at the same time not something you tell yourself, okay, now I'm going to interpret a piece of music and do it. It doesn't work that way. Into an interpretive process goes in your entire experience from life, as well as your musical knowledge, your awareness, everything. And it's really a spontaneous as well as a very planned process.
Part of that process is really understanding the architecture, so to speak, or the form of the music.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was interesting. I read a lot of your site and your writings. You write about your music. You also write about cookies and dogs and people who were, for example, the artist liaison who you worked with a particular orchestra. And it really struck me that your approach to music and to life is so much about relationships, all the different kinds of relationships that are going on around you and from you and toward you. And I was wondering if you could say a little more about that.
I think that humans are very social beings, and one can't survive in isolation. And, of course, life is about relationships.
And that makes its way into your music in so many different ways.
I think that everything I do, you know, they are intertwined with each other, including music.
You have a BA in psychology and gender studies and a master's degree in psychology. And I was wondering, what was the relationship between these studies and your music, if you could talk about that a little bit?
I think that everything is intertwined in my life. And so in psychology, I think, you know, I learned so much about the importance of the and the beauties of the intricacies of a mind, and that it's just so, everything is so individual. And, of whereas every piece of music is also very, very unique. But I didn't particularly study psychology, get my degrees in psychology in order to become a better player. I went to college, and I wanted to study to broaden my horizons. And in the long run, I think anything you experience in life, anything you have in life, anything you become aware of in life, because music is very much connected to the person, connected to the soul of the person, they all somehow come together and demonstrate themselves out in music. So it's very difficult for me to say that, psychology and the study of psychology do not affect my playing, but it's also not possible for me to say in what exact ways they interact with each other.
When I was reading that you'd studied gender studies, it made me think about the remaining gender gaps that there are or might be in music, and certainly there are many, many female musicians, and maybe it's already 50-50, but it seems like there still aren't that many female conductors. Is that true? Is that changing?
I work with conductors, and in the recent years, I think I see more and more opportunities that I get working with female conductors.
So you think it is changing?
I guess so.
The program you'll be playing in Santa Fe, tell us a little bit about how you put it together and about your collaboration with Robert McDonald, the pianist.
Mm-hmm. My collaboration with Bob McDonald is one of my oldest, my longstanding partnerships. And usually we come to a program together. We construct a program together. In this case, we first decided on doing the Brahms G major and built a program around it.
So when you build a program around it, you start with Brahms and
we usually start by selecting our main work for the concert.
And then other things that you think would complement it in some way?
Complement and contrast.
Well, Midori, I know you have very little time today, so I will let you go, and I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, and I look forward to being in Santa Fe.
We look forward to having you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to classical violinist Midori, who will be performing this coming Tuesday, October 27th at 7:30 at the Lenzing Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Concert Association. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org. My podcast site is santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the Detroit Suite, composed and conducted by 91-year-old Gerald Wilson.